from the mind of the sapient simian. This is Nobody's Prodigy. Free-range ideas from beyond the box. Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 6 of the Sapient Simian. I'm your host, the Clever Monkey, and episode 6 I'm going to call Fantastic Follies. In our 6th episode, I wanted to talk about big things, grand designs, epic accomplishments, and the will to make such things happen. The pyramids, the Leshan Great Buddha, the Taj Mahal, Machu Picchu, Easter Island. We're surrounded by examples of greatness, yet modern man tends to limit himself, perhaps unnecessarily. And that's one thing I wanted to tackle in this episode. Now, full disclosure, I am a lifelong dreamer. I am definitely the kind of person that has a tendency to imagine things of sort of epic proportions, grand scale kind of things. And I love the idea of large, big projects and ideas. I'm also interested in big ideas in general in terms of concepts and that sort of thing. That's kind of what this podcast is all about, of course. And, you know, so I have over the years seen lots of different really fascinating concepts and designs for, you know, be it buildings or various kinds of public constructions or designs for, you know, mass transit systems or any number of grand things that I just find to be really fascinating and really interesting. And I myself have dreamed of large scale things. One of the things I really enjoy watching in my spare time sometimes is some of the retrofuturism and some of the designs of the past of, you know, some of the large scale designs of new, you know, cities of tomorrow and those sorts of things, houses of tomorrow, and the idea of sort of reinterpreting all of society and all of the possibilities. And one thing you'll see in a lot of those is that, you know, there are new concepts, new technology, new sciences, and those sorts of things. But there's also a willingness to embrace sort of a large scale redesign of the world itself and sort of the layout of society and large scale projects in a way that, you know, I think that, you know, people are willing to imagine but don't necessarily happen. And one thing that really I lament as a person who tends to imagine things is, you know, I have said before, if it would kill me to do so, but at the same time, I do sometimes when I'm frustrated want to go back and tell those people in the 1950s, you know, they say in the year 2000, I want to say no, everything's basically just the same. The houses look the same, the cars look basically the same, people do basically the same things. I mean, as far as, you know, we have some kinds of technology and those sorts of things that are kind of interesting, but really, if you were to hover over your average city, you know, it would look basically the same. Even the buildings look basically the same. We pretty much haven't done any of those things. And I find myself wondering, why is that so? You know, because the truth is we live in a time when so much is possible. You know, humanity can literally move mountains at this point. I mean, we really have no realistic limitations, you know, in terms of the past, in terms of our ancestors, what they would have considered possible. I mean, we could build the ancient great works weekly. I mean, we could build a great pyramid, you know, in a few days in every city if we really wanted to. That's not beyond our capability and is really not even that difficult at this point. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, our production of these things has failed, and why is that so? When we have the ability to do such drastically large things, why is it that our production of these things has actually dropped off? we actually don't necessarily see those things coming about. And, you know, in a sense, I tend to blame capitalism, not necessarily to get too hot button kind of issue about it, but I think that the concepts of capitalism have really killed our ability to embrace large scale ideas. I think the problem is one of funding, and not necessarily funding in the sense that the money isn't out there, but funding in the sense that there's this idea of payout, of profit, the idea of a return on investment. You know, I think that, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that there are entrenched interests in different types of situations, especially when it comes to mass transit and some of those things. When it comes to, you know, placement of large, you know, when they were looking for where to put Mount Rushmore, for example, if you're going to put something like that out there, you know, there are geographic concerns, there are environmental concerns, but there are also, you know, governmental concerns about who gets that in their state, and you know, those entrenched interests can really affect a lot of things, and a lot of times they don't want disruption. So, you know, when it comes to things like new types of transportation, new types of energy, those sorts of things, they don't want disruption to the old order. But, you know, more in my opinion, as far as the capitalist side of things go, there is this idea that investment, capital, wants safe bets. They want things that are safe. They want things that are predictable. And, you know, to go back to the fact that our buildings and our cities look exactly like they did before, maybe not necessarily in large, you know, Dubai, for example, but, you know, when it comes to your average normal-sized town in just, you know, anywhere in America, it's going to look basically the same. Well, the main reason that is, as, you know, someone who has done house design, is that for the longest time, it was not possible to get a loan to build a building if it was considered to be too outside of the norm. There's this idea that when you build a building, the bank, if they're going to loan on it, they want to know that they're going to get their money back in the event they have to foreclose on it. And they look at other buildings that are similar, especially other houses, as a way of determining how much money they can get for it. And that's a way that they guarantee that the loan is actually a safe bet. So if you come along and you have a new, interesting, and unusual design for any kind of a building, but a house especially, they have a tendency to deny that because they say to themselves, we don't know what this is, we don't know that anyone would want it, we don't know how much it would be worth. And, you know, it's not to say that you wouldn't necessarily find people that work there that would appreciate it. I mean, but the problem is that the institutions themselves have policies that actually deny those things. So it becomes almost the only way to build is to build something that is in the style and in the design and in the layout of something that's already existed. So, you know, there again, the idea of capital investment and return on investment limits our ability to build something that is new and to redesign something. You know, and it's a short-term vision. You know, there are things that we know now about the way that we live that can be extrapolated into the future about new design and new building. And it's possible to make educated decisions about, yes, well, we know that these things will happen more, and we know that these things will happen less, and to make sort of long-term intelligent choices that would rectify that situation. But the people that are in charge of these things, and generally speaking, the people that have the ability to finance things and to make these things possible, have a very short-term vision. They generally look at things. House flipping, for example, is a very common thing. And the idea is that you don't look long term. You don't intend to keep anything long term. You only ever do something for the next. I mean, the idea of keeping something for 10 years is considered to be, you know, really kind of extreme. You know, you're only ever doing things in short bursts. So, you know, the fact that you don't think about things long-term, you don't have a long-term vision, means that you're only ever really patching things. You're only ever really making do. You're never sort of doing more. And I think a big problem of that is that you end up having architecture, but also other things, but, you know, sort of focusing on architecture as a theme. You end up having architecture that is built along the minimum. It's disposable in nature. I remember around my hometown when I was watching new things being built, and once I had learned a fair amount about construction, I came to realize how your average, say CVS for example, or other type of retail establishment. You know, it used to be built. If you go to an old department store, it was built out of brick, and it was built with, you know, corbels and arches and, you know, detail work and all sorts of things. Now, generally speaking, those buildings are built to be disposable. They're built with cinder block walls and steel struts across the roof and a flat roof, and it's just basically a glorified box that can be easily slapped up and easily knocked down so that they're never made to be kept. And, you know, the problem is that that disposability has all sorts of issues. And, you know, the idea that nothing has any longevity is an issue. And, you know, the American mindset, the capitalist mindset would argue, oh, well, these things are all transient anyway. You may have a Bojangles today and an AutoZone the next day. But, you know, when you look at places that have permanent architecture, things like Venice, for example, which is 100% based around its architecture, it manages to still be functional having buildings that are hundreds of years old. You know, there are towns and places that people go to specifically because the buildings are hundreds of years old, and they still manage to have convenience stores. They still manage to have pharmacies. It is not necessary to make a disposable building to make something that is worthwhile. What you end up doing, though, is the initial builder makes an investment that other people reap the rewards for. And, you know, and the initial builder is also building for something larger than themselves. And I think that's another big problem I run into a lot of times with building, is that most building done in this day and age is done by people that are not building for themselves. They're not building for something that they intend to use. When you buy a house that's pre-built, or when you buy a house that already exists, a lot of times it was built by someone, you know, if it's an older house, it was built by someone who was at least present. If it's a very old house, it might have actually been built by someone who helped in the building. But any sort of new house is built by people who have no intention of ever having anything to do with what's actually in that house. When they nail up a piece of drywall on the wall, they're never going to be in that room. They're never going to have to deal with the sound quality of that room, the thickness of the walls, the strength of the floor, the longevity of the roof, you know, any of those things. So they don't really care, you know, on a sort of deep level about the buildings that they're making. And the people that are paying them to build those are not building them for themselves either. They're building them, like I said, to flip them, to move them along. So, you know, that becomes a real issue when it comes to just the fact that nothing we have is worth anything. Nothing we have is worth hanging on to. Nothing we have has any real value. And if you travel around, nothing has any staying power. You know, which, like I say, goes back to the grand designs of the past and the fact that despite our abilities, we don't seem to do those things anymore. And when you look at those things, you know, there was a different view. There is a different view of those things. And I think that it would help us to sort of take on that view or to at least look at that perspective and understand that when it comes to those things, there is a different kind of value. There is a different kind of payback, a different kind of profit. Unfortunately, it's the kind that the people that do investing have no use for. But there is a long-term value. There is a long-term profit. There is a great longevity in greatness itself. You know, when you think about something like the Parthenon in Greece, you know, or the Acropolis itself, which is just the whole sort of downtown area of that period, that was built, you know, it took a fair amount of time to build. But when you consider the amount of time from that point forward that has been visited, has been, you know, a point that people will come to, a point that people will get value from, you know, for 1,000 years from that point forward, those initial investments can be seen to have enormous amounts of value, enormous amounts of profit. The actual value, the cost of, you know, the person that sat there and said, gosh, we're building the Parthenon. How much is it going to cost in marble? How much is it going to cost in labor? How much are we going to actually get back from it? Well, I mean, how could they have possibly calculated 1,000 years worth of people coming there and seeing the place? Just in terms of if they put up a stall and charged $1 admission. I mean, how could they have possibly calculated that? You know, there's not to mention there's a whole host of other types of value. There's cultural value. There's international value. There's any number of things. And, you know, there's a whole mess of what I would call economic froth around these things. If you look at San Michele, which is a small... It's almost like an island, but it's not 100% disconnected from the mainland. But it's a small place in France. It's a place where people went on pilgrimage. Or, for example, the cathedrals themselves that were built throughout the Middle Ages that were enormous expenditures of time and effort and money and were vast expenditures. Well, the idea with those were at least people would be coming around on pilgrimage to see all the different places and to see all the different relics, and you would get some sort of value from that. But the economic froth of those things are, you know, the when people came to see those cathedrals, they would buy food, they would stay in a hotel, they would, you know, do any number of things. I mean, even today you have people that buy T-shirts with Notre Dame on it. You know, you have puzzles people can buy with Notre Dame on it. So the initial investment has all kinds of, like I said, economic froth of creation of value beyond the initial investment that ends up being worth vastly more in the long run. But the problem is that the money is made for more people, not just for the actual person who put forward the investment, because you can't really copyright that. You can't really, you know, run around town charging everyone for the value that they get from sitting next to a building and absorbing the atmosphere, or, you know, the value they get from living in a country that has the Taj Mahal, and the value they get from having that sort of pride in their culture. You know, you can't get money for culture. You can't get money from that, that kind of greater value. And ironically, you know, even though the pyramids and other great sort of deeds were done by single individuals with sort of megalomania, feelings of great personal importance, the creation of grand designs are not necessarily aided by greed. They're not aided by you know, these monetary interests. You really need to have sort of a grander conception, a longer scale sense of what your actions do, or what the end result, the value is. Because, you know, these things have ability to define a culture, to define a people, you know, to define an era. These grand things, these grand accomplishments, you know, can really stand for times well beyond the end of the people themselves. There are any number of great works that we know very little about the actual people who made them, and yet the thing itself defines them, it defines their era, it defines their place in ways that are completely unable to be quantified. You know, so the person that actually paid to get the people to make Stonehenge, you know, when they were adding up the cost and trying to decide, oh, should we buy, you know, cheaper oxen or what have you, whatever it may be, they could not have ever calculated the long-term value. But, you know, it also works on a smaller scale. These things also work on, you know, they don't have to be the pyramids or the Taj Mahal. One thing that I look at, you know, from my perspective as someone who's not capable of building a pyramid, are small scale things like roadside attractions, which have the ability to find a place. You know, you take something like the world's largest ball of string, or the world's largest rocking chair, or even just a particularly large rocking chair. It doesn't even have to be the world's largest. Or if you're building a water tower and you make it look like Paul Bunyan, you know, or whatever it is, when you do something with a different thing in mind, and, you know, if you take a water tower and make it to be Paul Bunyan, there definitely is someone in that process who's going to say, look, they make pre-made water towers that everyone has that look exactly like all the others. They're a lot cheaper to put up. They're a lot easier to make. There's no reason to put all this extra money into it. And that's exactly why we don't have a better defined, a more interesting, and a grander world that we live in. Because doing the bigger thing is always more difficult to argue for in that discussion. And yet I think they have far more long-term and grander value. I think they have a value beyond those simple calculations. You know, if you're building a diner and you make it look like a bulldog, that is complicated and difficult and a grand and interesting thing to try to pull off. Now, your actual diner is probably going to be similar to others, and yet the fact that you take that extra time and you make it a thing, it has a place, it defines the era, it defines, you know, your culture, it defines your people, it has so much more to it. But there again, in order to do that right, you have to do that with heart and with quality. And, you know, that's one of the problems when it comes to roadside attractions is that, you know, you can't do that with a disposability in mind. You can't do that with the cheapest materials and those sorts of things. There's a tangible kind of love that's involved. And if you look at sort of the long-term success or survival of those things, they require an ongoing input of love and care to keep those up and going. But it's, you know, it's important to remember, and especially in today's culture, with today's sort of mindset, that when you do these things, you really have to embrace the concept of the fickle fads of fashion, that these things are made and they need a certain amount of loyalty. They require a certain amount of resolve in order to sustain them. If you look at all of these historical things throughout history, they all have a down phase. They all have sort of a low point. I mean, the pyramids were stripped for stone. The Colosseum of Rome was lived in by vagrants who also stripped the walls and the ceilings for stone and just, you know, took things out of it. Everything has a downside. The Eiffel Tower was hated by people for years and years. And when you do things on this grand scale, you have to understand that these things have this ebb and flow to them, and you have to be able to ride out those times. And like I said, they require an input of loyalty and an input of resolve. You know, at least, if nothing else, they require a certain amount of durability to ride through those periods. In my hometown, actually, we have a lot of old buildings from the 20s that are now very valued, and several of them are historic and are very, very popular. There is, which I had never heard of until I became interested in architecture, but there is a whole group of people that do architectural tourism that actually love to go to the city to see them. The only reason they exist in our town is because our town went through a real depression and people couldn't afford to tear them down. And the reason they don't exist anywhere else is because people did tear them down. So there was a point at which these designs and these buildings that we now love, that were built with such care, especially there's a lot of Art Deco and those sorts of things, some really great examples, and a lot of other things. And that's probably where my love of architecture comes from, seeing so many great examples. But they exist only because they rode through that down period because people simply couldn't afford to destroy them. It wasn't that they were somehow valued more than other places. So, you know, you really need to think on a larger scale if you're going to do these things. And it requires, which, you know, may or may not be possible, I would like to think is possible, it requires a certain amount of selflessness, being non-selfish. It requires the ability to see beyond your own ideas and concerns and those sorts of things. And sort of, you know, when you decide to deal with the peculiarities, well, I mean, when you decide that you can't build your condo where the pyramids are sitting because you're going to keep the pyramids for the good of the global culture, you're really putting up with the hardship of not being able to live in a place that obviously is open. You know, there are whole sections right up next to the pyramid that are fairly open, and that certainly you could put a house there And I'm sure there are people that look at it and say, why do I have to drive to the other side of town or even further or walk or any number of things? I mean, there's lots of hardship in the world, but why do I have to put myself out for the sake of, you know, maintaining this old dusty thing that I don't even care about, and it just makes my life more difficult? So it requires a certain amount of selflessness, and you know, you have to wonder to what extent that's possible. But you know, I believe it is possible. And ultimately, I think that, you know, the point of this particular episode is just to point out that I think we fail to seize these opportunities, that we live in a time when we have more opportunities, more capabilities, and more more chances to do greater things than we ever have. And we sell our futures short when we fail to take them. There's a quote that I really embrace that is not a common sort of American concept, a common capitalist concept, to be honest, which is that if you buy cheap, you get cheap. Which is to say, when you buy the least expensive, easiest thing, you end up with something that is not worth having in the long run. And, you know, it's going to break faster, it's going to wear out faster, it's not worth getting. If you want something that's worth having, you have to pay for it. But the thing is that when you do that, you get something that's worth having. And you will have it from that point forward. So, you know, I think sometimes things are worth doing without demanding worth in return, without demanding an immediate payout. And, you know, as I wrap up this episode, I just want to encourage everyone to think larger about things. Think more about the future and our own you know, our own legacy and what we leave behind, and also to imagine the possibilities. Imagine what we could do, and imagine what we could do if we set our mind to it. So, anyway, thank you for joining me today on our next episode. I look forward to the one after this, and hopefully you'll be there for it. I appreciate all you guys, and I look forward to seeing you real soon. All right, bye. If you're enjoying the show and would like to help me feed myself, keep the lights on, and continue making episodes, direct PayPal donations and other inquiries can be sent to thesapientsimeon@gmail.com. That's thesapientsimeon@gmail.com. I do have a Patreon page, also under The Sapient Simeon, where you can get exclusive access to view my other work from years past. Paintings, designs, projects, and experiments seen nowhere else. With your help, I can maintain the show as a commercial-free broadcast we all can enjoy. But a key part in that process is reaching out to encourage me and show your appreciation. In the meantime, I would like to thank you for listening and doing what you can to help share my work with others. Until next time, stay curious.